The NBA is mulling over sweeping changes to the schedule that could include an in-season tournament. Are these proposed changes good for the league?
And as always, the Western Conference is deep with contenders. We'll take a look at the top teams in the Western Conference when we play buy or sell. For Wes Goldberg, I'm David Ramil. It's Tuesday, November 26th, and you're listening to Locked On NBA.
You are Locked On the NBA, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to Locked On NBA, your daily NBA podcast. The NBA is considering making major changes to its playoff format, and the Mavericks have the look of a real contender. But let's start in Milwaukee, where the Milwaukee Bucks beat the Utah Jazz 122-118 on Monday night. Giannis scored a season-high 50 points with 17 rebounds to get his 17th straight double-double. Milwaukee trailed 57-48 at the half, but used a 10-0 run in the middle of the third quarter to pull even, thanks to Giannis' three-pointer from the top of the key that tied it at 74. Now, Giannis went 3-for-8 from three-point range in the game. Now, he's shooting 29% on 4.5 threes this season, but David, he's shooting 32% in November. It's a small sample size, but we know that Giannis is working on that three-point shot during the summer. Are you encouraged by what you're seeing? I mean, he's definitely shooting more of them, but are you encouraged by what you're seeing from him from three-point range?
I'm taking it as a small grain of salt. It's a good sign that he's willing to take the shot, unlike earlier in his career when he was just struggling so badly that he wouldn't take that shot, and he had so many other skills and so many other ways to score that he didn't necessarily need to incorporate it. But as the league has changed and evolved, and as he's grown as an individual player, he's expanded that range a little bit. And it's a fine percentage, I think. And the fact that he is improving as the season moves on is a good sign for the Bucks and for him as a player. He's talked about that 60% plateau that he was at and thinks that he can reach another level there. Maybe it's his long range shooting. And if we're starting to see that incremental growth, it's a step in the right direction at least. But look, I mean, he still got 50 points, regardless of the fact that he went 3-of-8 from 3-point range. I mean, 13-of-19 from the free throw line, despite his woeful shooting at the stripe there, 17-of-31 from the floor. Those are pretty huge numbers.
I mean, yeah, I mean, his numbers he's posting are MVP caliber yet again. And if you add the 3-point shot into that, we know that Mike Budenholzer, their coach, has been encouraging to shoot threes. I think I heard that, like, hey, just shoot it at the rim. The worst thing that can happen is you miss, right? And that's a great message for a guy who is still developing and is only 60% as good as he can possibly be, allegedly. So the fact that he's working on it, you know, how many times have we heard players who are so good at just one or two things, like that, who are so good at getting to the rim or so good in the mid-range area or something like that? I think of like a DeMar DeRozan type who just said, rejects the notion of three-pointers because he's so comfortable in that mid-range spot. But Giannis has been so open to stretching his own comfort zone and reaching the outer parts of his game in a way that we've seen the great players do. I mean, this is something we saw LeBron do. It took him years and years and years, but he finally worked on that three-point shot where now it's a reliable offensive guard. And I think for Giannis to be so open to it so early and just wanting, not just open to it, but wanting to put, I have no reason to think that it won't. Like, it's still clunky looking, right? But it looks better than it used to.
Yeah, I imagine that within 5 years, he'd probably be a pretty solid 35-38% shooter from 3-point range. And I think that's probably where he'll reach. And maybe he can even get as close to 40 somewhere down later on in his career. But for now, it is still struggling, but he's willing to take it. He's improved. And he'll probably continue to improve, not just this season, but beyond.
Things looked a little clunky in Milwaukee. I think early in the season, people were questioning whether or not they could survive the loss of Malcolm Brogdon and, you know, some of the veteran additions they made, like Kyle Korver and Wesley Matthews and stuff like that. Should they be starting Eric Bledsoe? Is George Hill the right guy? But this is a team with the best point differential in the NBA, one of the best records in the NBA right now, on the top of the Eastern Conference. I mean, and, you know, we'll talk about them here in a second, but the Sixers lost to the Raptors, and they're supposed to be their major competition, right? The Sixers are. The Bucks look like they are the cream of the crop in the East right now.
Yeah, that's a fair assessment. I think there's still so many questions regarding the Sixers and their lack of depth. And I think Milwaukee has proven they've another year without, obviously, Brogdon, but still another year with the core of this team intact, the same depth, the same kind of coaching. They don't need to go into it. I think that's a big thing that gets overlooked, is the fact that Budenholzer can start off this year building on what he already implemented last year, as opposed to having to start over the way he did at the start of last season.
That's a good point. And we just talked about the Sixers. Well, in their first meeting since Kawhi's dramatic buzzer beater in Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Finals, the Raptors beat the Sixers 101-96. And a big part of that was because Joel Embiid was held scoreless for the first time in his career. 0-11 from the field, missed all four of his three-point attempts. Not a good game from Joel Embiid. And I don't know if the, like, I wouldn't go so far as to say this is a red flag, but this was a big game, right, for the Sixers. I mean, the Raptors, even without Kawhi, are still pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you didn't bury the lead about Embiid there, because clearly he struggled, and not only that, but he compounded it by forcing shots that he didn't need to take. Marcus Saul continues to be a pretty solid defender, and he's always been very physical when it comes to matching up with a player like Embiid, and he clearly took him out of his comfort zone, 0 of 11 from the floor. That's something I never thought we'd see out of an MVP-type player like Embiid. But still, the fact that he was still taking those bad shots and continuing to make even worse decisions as the game progressed, as it was getting tighter and tighter, not a good sign. I know they've been through four games in six nights. I don't think that's a reliable excuse, not that anybody's necessarily using it as such, but you know, clearly he was fatigued. Probably he would have sat out more and more games in the past, and now he's continuing to play through these. So that's a positive sign, but against a bigger defender like Gasol, he probably should have had a little bit more in his bag than just the kind of woeful effort that we saw from him. But, you know, there were other factors as well. Ben Simmons struggled, not just with his shooting, only 4 of 8 from the field, 10 points in total. But he also made a number of costly turnovers, 7 turnovers for the game, especially down the stretch. He made some pretty wild passes there. And I know that Simmons is not a perfect player. He still lacks aggression, and sometimes he gets to the rim whenever he wants to, and then he just doesn't take that shot. So he's not necessarily the kind of reliable scorer that you'd want. And for him to be the kind of high-usage ball handler that he is and make these bad decisions doesn't show that he hasn't grown as much as a lot of people had hoped that he would at the start of the season.
Yeah, I guess on one hand, right, the fact that they only lost by 5 might be a positive sign, given that their two best players probably had a couple of their worst games of the season so far. But
sure,
to go, like, how much of Embiid going 0-for-11 and Ben Simmons coughing the ball up 7 times is just due to the fact that there's not a whole lot of spacing on this offense? It's the same problem that they had last year. And I know going into this year, you know, you eschew a guy like J.J. Redick and the spacing he brings for size, for length. I mean, you lose Jimmy Butler and J.J. Redick, you bring in Josh Richardson and Al Horford. I know Richardson's a good three-point shooter, but he's not J.J. Redick from beyond the arc there. So, you know,
he was 5 of 9 tonight. So I mean, he looked Redick-esque, if nothing else.
I don't want to say anything negative about Josh Richardson. I love Josh Richardson, but I do think that this problem is symptomatic of the limitations of Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons as players. And look, how many times have we compared Joel Embiid to Shaquille O'Neal? Like, Shaq, I don't want our listeners to call me out if this actually happened, but like, I don't think Shaq ever went 0-for-11, right? Like,
no, not until later on in his career.
Yeah, maybe old Shaq, who was like, you know, should have been in his team chair by then, but yeah. The big leprechaun might have went 0-for-11. But Shaq Diesel never went 0-for-11. And, you know, I guess, you know, you have Marcus Saul, who has, you know, historically guarded Joel Embiid pretty well, but 0-for-11 is still really bad. Ben Simmons coughing the ball up 7 times. They need to figure out, again, that two-man game, because I think a lot of it probably has to do with just the fact that teams are clogging the paint against that team, against those two players specifically. And I don't know what the answer is other than Josh Richardson taking 18 three-pointers.
And I mean, Tobias Harris, And Tobias Harris has been shooting pretty well too. And you know, we're focusing on Philadelphia playing badly, or at least Embiid playing badly in particular. But the reality is that Toronto Raptors are still a good team without Kyle Lowry, without Serge Ibaka, without Stanley Johnson and others. They, I mean, they still went out there and put up a pretty strong effort at home. They're 12-4 overall. They're one of two undefeated teams in the Eastern Conference at home, along with Miami, both 7-0. I mean, this is pretty impressive from the Raptors group. I know I was a little down on the Raptors. I wasn't sure how they'd be able to respond, but they've clearly got a chip on their shoulder, and they're still looking like they're at least willing to prove that they're a potential title contender even still this year.
Nice of you to throw in Stanley Johnson's name there. That was very admirable of you.
He's a key contributor.
But, he's a guy on that team. No, I'm with you. I think you look at this. We came into the season thinking, okay, it's Milwaukee and it's Philadelphia, and everybody else is very far behind. But like we just talked about, it seems like Milwaukee is far ahead of everybody else. But Toronto and Miami are right there. I mean, do you have a favorite in the Eastern Conference, or at least maybe a team that you think will presumably meet Milwaukee in the Eastern Conference Finals right now, if you had to pick?
No, I don't. I mean, I think the clear favorite is probably still Philadelphia, even though they don't look the part. Yeah. I imagine that they would tighten things up a little bit. And you never know whether or not they're able to pick up a veteran on the waiver wire at some point, or maybe even make a trade down the line, although they don't have much to trade right now. They also need internal development. You know, they had some problems with Matisse Thybulle. He struggled a little bit. He gets into early foul trouble. And I know a lot of people are expecting him to be this kind of staunch defender the same way he was at the collegiate level, but he could also get into that kind of foul trouble. And, you know, he's a rookie. He's going to make mistakes. And so their depth does get exposed on occasion, especially when they face high-end teams like Toronto.
Now, Toronto expected Miami better than most people expected, but probably not better than you and I expected, because we were high on Miami. Probably a little bit better than we expected, but it's going to be fun. The Eastern Hand should make for a very interesting playoffs. Speaking of the playoffs, the NBA is going to make changes to their playoff format, or presumably they are trying to. We'll talk about that next here on Locked On NBA.
The NBA is considering dramatic changes to the league calendar that would include a reseeding of the four conference finalists, a 30-team in-season tournament, and a postseason play-in. These scenarios would result in a shortened season to a minimum of 78 games. Let's start with the load management side of this, David. Is knocking off four games enough?
Well, I don't think it's really knocking off four games exactly. If I understand the nature of the play-in tournament, you're still winding up playing a number of games. So, in fact, some teams might wind up even playing as many as 83 games. So it depends on how it works in as far as the play-in tournament towards the end of the season, and of course the in-season tournament as well, that just kind of rebrands regular season games as part of this fictional tournament that we're discussing here. So I'm not sure that it's not necessarily just the same thing as saying, oh, we're going to lop four games off the schedule. It's just going to change whether or not those four games count as regular season games or as part of these tournaments that are going to be bracketing and rebranding these games that are being played anyway. So it's not like, you know, players are going to be sitting out games and having more opportunity to rest. In fact, they might wind up playing even more games. So I'm not sure that there's a load management component to this that the Players Association is really considering.
It feels like they're framing it that way, though, right? Like, hey, we're kind of this. There's a potential here for a lot of teams to only play 78 games versus 82 games, and if you put a lot of these extra games into this midseason tournament, then maybe you're knocking off some back-to-backs elsewhere in the schedule. But I agree with you. I don't think there's really like a realistic load management sort of side of this whole thing. There's a whole other set of issues that we're about to get to, but it does feel almost like when the college football playoff came out and they were like, hey, we have four teams in this college football tournament. And everybody's like, yeah, we always think that there needs to be at least eight. And they're like, yeah, but this is like a starting point. This feels like a starting point. Like they should probably get down to about 70 games at some point. But let's talk about this 30-team in-season tournament, because that to me is the most interesting thing. It seems to me to be aimed at tanking. By incentivizing players in a front office with cash to win regular season games, it's giving teams that may have been aiming to tank a reason to go out and try to win games in November and December, which is when this tournament would take place.
Yeah, and I guess that's the overall goal of this, is to eliminate the kind of process that we've seen in the past of teams losing games on purpose, especially even at this point when fandom is really starting to build up, and as far as the regular season is concerned during the holiday season. If you look at it from this tournament perspective and kind of make these performances a little bit sexier, maybe it's more appealing for fans. And so you don't want to see teams that are like actively tanking at this point in the season already. So it makes a lot of sense to kind of incentivize them and get them engaged a little bit early on. So, I mean, it seems like, I mean, I'm not quite sure I'm sold on it 100%, because I'm not sure how it's going to work as far as a framework is concerned. And I think from everything I've read, it seems like the top tier teams are probably not likely to take it seriously, because again, they're already playing for something much greater as far as the end of the season and the postseason. It's not like they're looking at this tournament and saying, well, this is a reason for us to continue to win as many games as possible. They're going to win a lot of games regardless, because they are these top seeding teams, and the tournament doesn't have really any incentive towards them winning those games anyway.
Yeah, it's really for those bottom feeder teams that right. may be ready to just sort of throw in the towel. I mean, because right. we're already seeing this. We're in the middle of November. We're mid to late November here, but we kind of already have an idea of which teams are going to be taking.
You're seeing a lot of it, I think, yeah.
Yes, I am. But it gives teams like, you know, the Warriors, the Knicks, and all these other teams just a little bit of stakes, right? Like in the middle of, and for the NBA, it's good from a TV rating standpoint, because, I mean, you just mentioned this is really the time of year when people are starting, like the NBA fandom is starting to ramp up. I mean, the Christmas, in that Christmas day slate of games is really kind of considered the unofficial tip-off to the NBA season, right? For most casual fans, not fans listening to this show. But
let me ask you a little bit then, covering the Warriors as much as you do and seeing them, you know, be, you know, not necessarily actively tanking perhaps, but maybe, you know, going through a number of injuries. Do you think that this group as currently constructed would be a little bit more incentivized to win these in-season tournament games?
Maybe. I mean, for the Warriors specifically, they just like opened up a new arena. So maybe you don't load manage Draymond Green quite as much during this tournament just to kind of make a quick buck.
Right.
But that's be about it. I mean, you're not going to like Stephen Curry and Klay Thompson aren't going to suddenly show up for this tournament, right? They're actually
they're not getting healthy. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Let's talk about these playoff changes. A 4-team play-in for the final two spots in the playoffs, plus a reseeding of the final four teams left, which could ensure that the best two teams make it to the NBA Finals. What are your thoughts on this? Which one of these, for the play-in for the last two teams or these changes to the final four teams, what do you think is most interesting?
Ooh, that's a tough one. To me, honestly, it's probably, as far as more interesting, I would say it's the play-in for the final two spots. That gives like those, not necessarily bottom feeders, but like the 6th through 10th seed of the conferences, you know, a little bit more incentive as far as winning those late season games and things of that sort. We saw this last year with Miami where they were kind of already realizing they were a little bit out of it and they didn't really have much incentive to keep pushing it other than to continue to have as many wins as possible for Dwayne Wade's retirement tour. But if he had the promise of another playoff series in the future, maybe he would have been a little bit more geared up for those games. Maybe the team would have changed the way they approached these late April games or mid-April games right before the postseason. So to me, that's kind of more exciting. I think fans in general would probably find the final four teams, the best teams in the league playing against each other a little bit more excited because then you have the sexier matchups as far as having the top teams in each conference facing each other, or regardless of conference, the top teams regardless, I mean, period.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think I was looking at last year. It wouldn't have really made a difference. I mean, we would have had
took
the final four teams of last year because Portland ended up making it to the conference finals. You would have had Milwaukee and Portland playing against each other in one playoff series, and then Toronto and Golden State playing each other in the second playoff series. And the Warriors were not as injured in the conference finals as they were in the NBA finals. I wonder how that would have changed things. Then you had Milwaukee would have beaten Portland probably. So you would have probably ended up with Milwaukee and Golden State in the finals. Probably. Mm. You could have ended up with a situation with Milwaukee and Toronto still. But we saw Milwaukee and Toronto and we saw Toronto versus Golden State. We didn't see Milwaukee versus Golden State. That would have, you know, Giannis versus the Warriors. Warriors fans would frame it as Giannis versus his future team. I don't think that's happening, but I don't know how much different it would have really been.
Yeah, that's interesting, though. I mean, I think with him winning MVP, maybe it would have been a little bit more exciting for the casual fan to say, well, this is a player I recognize already on the biggest, you know, I think as good as Kawhi Leonard is, I think most casual fans probably aren't even aware of who Kawhi Leonard is. You know, he was a role player in San Antonio, and although he carried the Raptors to their first championship, I still don't think he has that cross-sectional appeal.
Well, I think at that point, he probably didn't, but after all the memes from during the summer, they probably know who he is now.
Hey, really? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
What it do, baby?
That's all it takes now. That's all it takes now. Yeah, what it do, baby? That's all it takes now. Let's talk about this play-in, though, because it's kind of this MLB wild card scenario. I think that the major value in this is just, again, like the in-season tournament a little bit, but more transparently, curbing tanking, both between the in-season tournament and having an ability to play in. Because if you're one of these teams that looks pretty locked into maybe the 10th spot in the conference, and now all of a sudden the possibility of winning this play-in tournament, so to speak, and then making the NBA playoffs, and then in turn getting a little bit extra revenue from ticket sales, that could be enough of a reason for a lot of these teams to say, you know what, we're not going to tank. We're not going to go from the 10th seed to let's rest off all our players and go to like the 12th spot in the East or the West. Let's take this 10th spot and really try to be playing our best basketball at this point to maybe make the playoffs and get a little bit extra cash.
You know, one of the things that I like a lot about it too is it's kind of like an appetizer or a little something to whet the appetite a little bit for the postseason games that actually matter. Like you're building this excitement as teams kind of play in there. A lot of people start, I mean, I think most hardcore fans probably aren't like this, but even the casual fans, they don't really watch the quarterfinal matchups, the 1 versus 8 seeds, because generally you know who's going to advance from that. But if you have this play-in series taking place, this play-in tournament, maybe that starts building up your interest a little bit more. And maybe these lower-seeded teams might have a little bit more understanding of what it takes to knock off these 1 seeds. I think we probably see more... what's the word I'm looking for? I'm more competition there, more likely. Yeah. They might be more parity. Likely to knock. Yeah. More likely to knock off these 1 seeds, like kind of what we see in college basketball, I think, as far as those tournaments concerned.
That's a good point. Yeah. You build a little bit momentum. Maybe you can, there's a little bit more of a chance for an upset there.
Yeah.
I know we're going to do buy or sell next, but quickly buy or sell these changes.
I'm buying, man, to be honest with you. I wasn't quite sure about it, but now that I've kind of talked my way through it, I kind of like it.
I'm with you. And initially, I'm a traditionalist. I was like, this seems weird, but yeah. I'm buying it. Why not? It's more fun. Coming up, we know Luka Doncic is the real deal, but are the Mavericks?
Audible has the world's largest selection of audiobooks and audio entertainment. Start listening with a 30-day Audible trial. Choose 1 audiobook and 2 Audible originals absolutely free. Visit audible.com/lockedonNBA. Listening on the go? If you can't visit Audible right now, you can find this and all other offers from Locked On sponsors at lockedonpodcast.com/offers.
3 of the top 4 teams in the West play tonight, with the Mavericks hosting the Clippers and the Nuggets taking on the Wizards. With the Lakers leading the West, that rounds out the teams who would have home court advantage if the playoffs were to start today. David, let's start with Luka's team. Are you buying or selling the Mavericks as a contender in the West?
I'm selling. Who's the third leading scorer in the Dallas Mavericks roster right now? I mean, it's Tim Hardaway Jr. I mean, but I had to look it up because I wasn't even sure. Like, Kristaps probably getting an inordinate amount of touches, and he's the second leading scorer. But I think this team is being carried so greatly by Luka Doncic, it doesn't feel like it's sustainable for the long term. Like, I think there's still holes in their defense that are pretty glaring there. I'm not sure that this team is a legitimate contender. It's been great to watch, and it's fine. Like, I'm okay with them being a potential playoff seed, maybe even one of these teams that down the road we'd actually see them kind of play in for a playoff season. I mean, could you imagine that, Luka Doncic, with a game on the line in this play-in tournament that we were just talking about, trying to get the Mavericks into the postseason? That would be great, because I think he's up for that kind of challenge. But at the same time, I just don't see the Mavericks and the composition of that roster and look at them and say, you know what, they're a legitimate playoff team. So, they might be a playoff team. I don't see them as a contender.
They're the best offense in the league. Their defense is middling at best. I think a lot of Mavericks fans would point to the fact that they have the second best point differential in the NBA behind only the Milwaukee Bucks. They're plus 9.2. I would also say that a lot of that is inflated because they beat the Golden State Warriors by 48 points. So if you subtract that Warriors game out of there, I think they're still a good team. They still have a positive point differential, but it's not nearly the second best in the NBA. I'm with you. I'm selling Dallas Mavericks. I think they've fleshed out the team with good role players. Kristaps Porzingis still has a long ways to go to get back to his peak performance. Luka Doncic is a real deal MVP contender, but I don't think that the Mavericks as a whole are a real deal contender in the Western Conference, especially when you stack them up against a team like the Lakers and the Clippers, who have several guys that they could throw at Luka Doncic and a whole lot of other a deeper bench, a whole lot more superstar players than Dallas has. Let's put the Lakers and Clippers on hold a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about the Denver Nuggets. I haven't been as impressed with a lot of people with Denver. I know that they're 9-1 in their last 10. They're on a 5-game winning streak. I still think that there's going to be a little bit of a regression for them from last season. I think what we saw at the beginning of the season kind of showed that. They've got some things going in their way. I know Jokic is in better playing shape. He's been playing harder and better overall, but what are your thoughts on the Nuggets as a legitimate team to come out of the West?
You know, I feel like we go through this exercise every year. Maybe it's because of the Denver Nuggets, or maybe it's because we're not sure about the composition of this team. But, you know, I just don't know if I can trust them as a legitimate contender. I always feel like they're a paper tiger of the highest order, where they're going to win a lot of games because they have incredible home court advantage. They play defense at a really high level, which is certainly a factor in their favor, but their offense is struggling. It's kind of middling a little bit as well. And so you look at this roster, you look at this team, and I don't know if they're strong enough to knock off any of the teams in the Western Conference, like those top four teams in the Western Conference. I mean, maybe they're better than the Mavericks, but I certainly wouldn't put them in the same tier as the Clippers or Lakers. And so I have questions. I think they're a great team. I think they're a good playoff team. I also don't think that they're a contender, so I am selling on the Denver Nuggets.
Yeah, you look at the Clippers, they have Kawhi and Paul George, and then a very deep bench anchored by Lou Williams and Montrezl Harrell. Those are, like, legitimately good players. You look at the Lakers, obviously headed by LeBron and Anthony Davis. For Denver, they've got Nikola Jokic, but then who, right? I know Jamal Murray is supposed to be that guy there, but Jokic is so much further ahead of him as far as being a superstar player. I mean, Jokic is legitimately a top 10 player in the NBA, and he gives them such an interesting, different dynamic. I think that helps them in the regular season. It helps them win games because you're not going to play another team like Denver, right? So whatever you scouted beforehand and whatever you're doing doesn't help you when you're playing the Nuggets. And they've obviously got that home court advantage. So I think they're a regular season team, not necessarily built for the playoffs, unless whether it's Jamal Murray or somebody else sort of leaps into that upper echelon tier of top 20, 30 player, which they just don't have that behind Jokic. And I think you need that second option in the playoffs. And by the way, that's what hurt them in the playoffs last year. I know Jamal Murray had a couple of good games, but he also had a couple of stinkers that really hurt them.
Absolutely. I mean, Paul Millsap's playing really well. Will Barton's playing well, but I just don't see either of those players emerging as the legitimate second or third option on this team.
Should we go an episode without talking about the Lakers or Clippers? I mean, they're contenders. We're buying both of them, right? I mean, that's pretty simple. Any thoughts on what you've seen from the Clippers with Kawhi and Paul George?
I think they're going to be really good, to be honest with you. I'm not sure if – I don't know if they're the best team in the Western Conference by a long shot, but I know that they're going to be a threat for the title.
Do you still like them over the Lakers?
I know I did. I think so. I'm a little surprised by the Lakers' strong commitment to defense, and I wonder how sustainable that is and whether or not we'll see that in April and May. But for now, I think the Clippers are still the better team.
I think the Lakers' commitment to defense is real, and it's because of LeBron James. He looks actually engaged on that end for the first time in a long time. And I think he's doing that because there's a reason, because they can legitimately win the title this year. I still like the Lakers more than the Clippers, but we'll see. Maybe they'll be reseeded and playing each other. I don't know. I don't know how this works yet. Remember to listen to and subscribe to new and archived episodes of Locked On NBA on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. If you're on iTunes, rate us, review us, say nice things about us. For David Ramil, I'm Wes Goldberg, and this has been Locked On NBA.